So I'm going to say a little prayer too. Dear God, thank you so much for bringing us all together. We thank you for this time of celebration. Please help us to remember that when we get together and celebrate, we celebrate you. You have entered our hearts and our minds in a way, and our lives in a way that we cannot describe. Without you, there is no Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no liberty, there's no freedom, there's no celebrations, there's no Christmas, there's no New Year's. A lot of us here, sometimes, God, we come to these rooms and we're people looking for refuge. We're looking for refuge from our pain, from our resentments, from our fears, from things that were done to us. And we seek refuge for the shame and the guilt and the sorrow of the things and the pains that we've caused to others. We seek refuge from our regrets. We seek refuge from our past. We thank you, dear God, for this moment, so that all of us may come together and seek refuge in you. Help us to find that refuge inside of ourselves. May we discover your peace, your love, your power, and your mercy in our hearts and our minds and our souls. At this time of celebration, dear God, let us celebrate you. And we thank you for this time and this moment to say thank you, God. And I ask you to please, dear God, remove whatever is blocking me from these people. Please remove, dear God, whatever is blocking these people from me. And most importantly, dear God, please remove whatever is blocking us from you so that we may have an open heart and a new open mind. Please set aside everything that we think we know for an open mind and a new experience with the unmanageability of our spirits. Please help us see the truth. Amen.
Amen.
And first week, we talked about the physical allergy. We talked about what it was like when we put booze in our system, the physical reactions. We went through parts of the process to ask ourselves, do we have this? You know, when I put booze into my system, does my body keep asking for more? And then the next week we talked about the mind, you know, the alcoholic mind, the mind that keeps leading us back to a drink or something else that's out to kill us. And this week we're going to talk about, you know, with God's help, the unmanageability of spirit, you know, that third part and second part of the first step. But the third part of the description of, am I an alcoholic? And I've said before, there's definitely things that I'm going to miss. When we talk about the spiritual malady, you're probably going to come up with some really neat ideas and some neat things that I haven't gotten to. And you're right. And but this is what's coming out today. So thanks for the opportunity as far as that goes. And also thank you for everybody here who is here, right? And talking about that unmanageability, talking about, you know, the mental, you know, mind of an alcoholic without a drink. I'm traveling over here last week. I'm looking to, you know, I'm coming from my place in Brooklyn. I'm traveling to get onto the BQE, and you know, I get into an accident. My car no longer will drive or move into park or anything, or out of park, and my car had to be towed. And I'm sitting on the, you know, 3rd Avenue and 57th Street in Brooklyn with everything from my car, because my car's being towed, and I'm loaded up my car with Christmas stuff and cards and, you know, things to go see my parents, because I have to work on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and I'm planning to spend these couple of hours with my folks and family to have something special. All my Christmas stuff is out on the, you know, the streets of Brooklyn. People are honking and all this other stuff going on. And I have to get a taxi cab to go back to my place in Brooklyn and try to figure out, you know, how am I going to get to Middletown, New Jersey, to ask my parents if I could borrow their car. And the mind, the alcoholic mind, the ego, immediately drops in and says, you know, what a loser you are. You know, You know, you're a loser in this family drunk, and you're a loser in this family sober. You can't get it together. Look at you, 10 years sober, and you've got to call up mom and dad to borrow their car. That's how this thing works. You know, drunk or sober, it may not say, Finley, go get a drink. You know, it may not say, let's go out and do some other things that may affect our sobriety. You know, it may not say, go to the clubs and the other places that kind of give us some momentary relief. It says things like that. It says you're a loser, you're no good, you're not making it, you can't get along, you screwed up things too much, there's no way you're going to ever surmount, you know, your mistakes and obstacles in your past. Now, you know, it could say those other things about, like, go have a drink and all this other stuff, but, you know, my ego kind of knows that, you know, the possibilities of slipping a drink in front of me right at that second, I may turn it away. But with that other line of thinking, it's going to, you know, I'm more apt to wanting to check out of life. Just end it all. Right? This disease wants me dead. It'll settle for me drunk. My sponsor said that to me over and over again. I hear him preaching it still today where he's out and about. And how more true. And so I think the faces of the people that are in this room that come out and support a guy like me, who is just a drunk, who is just another alcoholic, who's in desperate need of this power, who's in desperate need of God and desperate need of all of you, either to share some sort of story about how I was able to get through a particular problem, or to hear yours. And thank you folks from Freehold. I was in Freehold my first year of sobriety, and it was ugly. I went to that clubhouse. You know, I was wanting to kill myself, you know, without a drink in me. But you guys had meetings around the clock. You know, always had a place to go at that Freehold clubhouse. I remember it well, and it was a fond place in my heart. So thank you all for being here. And to discuss the spiritual malady, I think it's kind of interesting to hear what science has to say about it, right? Would you like to hear what science has to say about spiritual life, right? You know, because, you know, some of us are not really interested in this whole idea of the spiritual thing that goes on in AA. And that's okay. That's totally cool, right? You know, like, to everyone, this thing comes in a different way. We're just going to get into the idea of defining what it is that AA says is this spiritual malady, and we're going to talk a little bit, maybe to start off, of what science has to say about it. So, we talked about it a few weeks ago. There's this guy, his name is Dr. Silkworth. Silkworth, at the time when this book was written, was the number one doctor in the country, of the probably number one hospital in the country for dealing with alcoholics and drug addicts, right? And the best that science was doing with people like me in those days was, some physical treatment, some mental treatment. But if you were a chronic relapser, if you kept coming over and over and over again, finding yourself into another jam, another jackpot, another asylum, another institution, they eventually locked you away for good. That's what science had for us. Now, this guy Silkworth had dealt with 51,000 cases of alcoholics. This guy knew the deal. Like, he probably knew the deal of alcoholics better than the alcoholic, right? He dealt with so many of us. And in this opinion, you know, in this chapter, the doctor's opinion, he writes a letter, to alcoholics by the request of a couple of drunks, by the request of a couple of patients of his, okay? And so, in this doctor's opinion, on page XXVII, right, the doctor writes, says right here, the doctor writes, okay, just remember, this is the doctor, the number one chief physician for alcoholism, right? The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Paramount importance, right? So if we're looking at a mountain, right, the top of the mountain is the paramount. Right? There is nothing above the paramount of the mountain. There's nothing more important to the alcoholic from the scientist then the subject that is presented in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, from which our fellowship was created. Okay, where you'll find the program of recovery, where you will find the identification process if you're a real alcoholic or not. Right here in this book, he says that the subject presented in this book is the most important of all things in the subject of alcoholism to the alcoholic in this book. Okay? And I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addiction, Towns Hospital, New York, which is right down the road from where I used to work, Central Park West, you know, I think between like 82nd, 83rd, and that kind of, you know, on the Upper West Side over there, right? You can walk past it, and you can see a little plaque in front of the place that says, this was Towns Hospital, so on and so forth, right? So it's a place that existed, it's real, you can touch it and feel it, okay? So, a little bit down the road, here's the scientist, the doctor, talking about, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics. You know, what is moral psychology? Right? Hey Siri, what is moral psychology? I don't know, she's gonna listen.
Moral psychology is a field of study in both philosophy and psychology. Some use the term moral psychology relatively narrowly to refer to the study of moral development. Should I keep going?
That's good for now. Thank you. Right?
My pleasure.
So, okay, we're talking about moral development. What does that have to do with alcohol? What does that have to do with booze? What does that have to do with a can of Budweiser? Right? This doctor is saying that he knows for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics. That's a question. Do I believe that to be true for myself? Have we found ourselves doing things that were against our moral code? Have we found ourselves doing things that we said we would never do? I would never do that. I would never treat her like that. I would never do that to my girlfriend. I would never do that to my mom. And then I find myself doing all of those things to my mom, to my girlfriend, against my own code. I used to live a life, I call it the gospel according to Michael. And it was my code. But the problem with the gospel according to Michael was it constantly was changing because I constantly had to rewrite the book as I kept breaking new laws of my own code. Right? Forget about the gospel of Luke and John and some of these other really cool like ways of life out there. I couldn't even live the one that I was making up for myself. And it was one that if you didn't live up to it, I didn't like you. You were a jerk. You annoyed me. You were in my book. Right? So, the doctors believe that some form of moral psychology, moral development is needed and of urgent importance to alcoholics. My sponsor had me underline that word, moral psychology. He had me write in the margin here, spiritual awakening. The doctors are already talking about it. But he says, but its application of a spiritual awakening of moral psychology presented its difficulties beyond our conception, beyond the conception of scientists. What? With our ultra-modern standards, a doctor's approach to everything, we are perhaps not so well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic minds. So he's trying to say, or synthetic knowledge, so he's trying to say, I can't turn an immoral guy moral. I can't turn a guy who's doing bad into doing good. When it comes to alcoholics, right? He's saying that it's outside of his scope, outside of his professional experience to be able to do this, right? My sponsor had me write underneath the word good God. We are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book, a guy named Bill Wilson, comes to them and he asks if he can carry along this program to a bunch of other sick people. Right? He later talks about the people who have gone through this 12-step process. The people that he saw as patients in his hospital go through this 12-step process. This is what he says about the people who have gone through the 12-step process. He calls them the unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. So what is he saying? Through his experience dealing with the 51,000 cases of alcoholics, most of them were selfish, were always out to do things to get things better for themselves, were isolators and had no community spirit whatsoever, and weren't inspiring at all to this guy. Right? This is what his experience was before this book came to this doctor, before this program, and before this guy, Bill, presents this idea to this doctor and his patients. His experience with alcoholics are, they're selfish, they're self-centered, and they're, you know, they've got no community spirit, they're only out for themselves. This is what this guy sees with alcoholics. This is this guy's experience with 51,000 cases of alcoholics. Why do we know that? Because he wouldn't use these words if they were all of a sudden unselfish and having a profit motive, absence of profit motive, right? You know, doing something for not looking for something in return, right? Community spirit, whatever. This is not what this guy sees when he sees people like us, right? So he's talking about a change of behavior that he witnesses right before his very eyes from somebody from who's, you know, in a bed, maybe strapped down with DTs, to a guy who's gone through a 12-step process. He's a different person. That's what the doctor's saying. He's not even talking about a drink either, right? Here's another thing, and this is amazing for a guy like me. They believe in themselves. They believe in themselves. Did anybody, when they came in here, believe in themselves? You know, not me. I mean, I may have believed in certain things, certain abilities, certain things that I could do or whatever, but I was actually afraid to do them. I got myself so paralyzed that I was afraid to go out. I was afraid to do things. I was afraid to talk to the girl. I was afraid to break up with her. I was afraid to ask her out. You know, I went to performing arts school. I was afraid to get on stage again. I was afraid to not get on stage again. I believed in my talent, I believed I could do things, but I got so boxed in by this disease, by this illness, by this thing, I couldn't do one way or the other way. I was so trapped in the fear, right? He says they believe in themselves, and still more, they believe in a power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Has anybody found themselves or identifies with this idea of being at the gates of death? Right? The gates of death. There's lots of ways we can look at it, right? Some people, they get pulled out of their car, literally. The jaws of life are pulling open these cars, right? Some people are waking up, you know, after an OD experience. Hey, how are you? We just brought you back to life. We gave you the pen, all this other stuff. That's the literal gates of death. Find yourself smashing your car into a telephone pole, blood down your face. Next thing you know, you see the red and the blues, right? Or you're waking up in a hospital. There's literal gates of death, right? You know? But then, and then there's me, right? I'm suicidal. I want to check out of life no matter what. You make me uncomfortable, I'm checking out. That's the way this thing goes for me. You make me uncomfortable, I'm running to the bar. You make me uncomfortable, I'm running up into the garage. I'm going down to the garage and taking care of some business that no one knows about, right? You know, you make me feel uncomfortable, I want to die, right? I'll settle for the drink. I'll settle for something else. I'll settle to go to the club or some other kind of thing. But the truth is deep down inside, I want out because I can't deal. I'm suicidal. I identify with this idea of gates of death. And, you know, there is a part of me that's also very, afraid of the suicide that I just wish it to come. Does anybody identify with that? And then there's another kind of death with a good friend of mine pointed out to me not too long ago, and that's a spiritual death, right? There's this word, it's called sloth, right? And sloth doesn't just mean that I'm lazy. Sloth doesn't just mean that I'm a procrastinator. Sloth doesn't just mean that it takes me a long time to do things. Sloth means that I know what the right thing to do is. I know what the difference between right or wrong. I know what course that I can and should take to get out of this, and I don't do it. I don't even, my spirit is so dead. I know there's good things to do. I know that there's an action I can take. I can call a minister. I can go to a meeting. I could call a friend who's had an experience, whatever. And I don't do it. Right? Spiritual death. Right? I know this isn't right, the way I'm treating her. I can go to a program. I can go seek some outside help or whatever. I don't do anything about it. Spiritual death too. Does anybody identify with any of these things? Okay. So now we got the doctor on XXVIII, which is the next page. All right. He talks a little bit up top about the phenomenon of craving occurring in chronic alcoholics. We talked about that in week one, right? People who can't stop drinking once they put the booze in their system, all right? Some people who were here identified with that. I definitely do, okay? I say this because we're going to bring up this chronic alcoholic a few times here. He says that these chronic alcoholics, chronic relapsers, right? People who can't control the drink. He says in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. This isn't a minister. This isn't, you know, the Pope. This isn't, you know, a church. This is the doctor who has seen 51,000 cases of alcoholics. He's saying that they got to be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So he's also telling you, you need to recreate your life. What you've been doing, with or without a drink, isn't working. With or without a drink, it ain't happening. You need a recreation, right? And also, you know, my sponsor's such a great guy, right? He knows that I'm sick. He knows that I'm a nervous wreck. He knows I've got no self-confidence. He knows I want out at any minute. He tells me, he underlines this, and he says, that's a promise, dude. That's a promise. You can be resurrected. You can be made new. You can recreate your life. Your life can be recreated. If you just follow these 12 steps and do this deal, you will have that. Right off the bat, page XXVII, I'm not even on page one. This guy's giving me promises. We talked about the promises in week one. Here's some more promises, and we haven't even gotten into the numbers yet. Right? A little bit down the line, the doctor, again, remember, the doctor, this is science. This isn't me. Right? Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Right, that's me. We talked about that before. I like that. Right? To them, their alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. Do people identify with that? Mm. Right? To me, the only normal thing is going to the Yankee game 8 hours early with my car, with my cooler in the lot, you know, with a case of, you know, beer and a cooler of booze and mixers. You know, this thing, to me, the normal life is showing up to a Yankees game 8 hours early. And then also hanging out in that same lot 8 hours later and bribing the guy who closes the gate to give me the lock so I can close it up at sundown or sunrise. You know, I get out of there when the cops, you know, change their shifts. Right? That's, to me, a normal life. To me, that's normal. That's what normal people do. The normal people, you know, go to work. You know, then they hop on a subway or jump in their car. They park the car, they go into the game, and then they get in the car and they leave. Right? But to me, that's normal. Okay. All right. But here's the deal. He's going to talk about the spiritual condition right now. He says the chronic alcoholic, the real alcoholic, is restless, irritable, and discontented. Does anybody identify with restlessness, irritability, and discontentment without a drink? Yeah? Here's another way to look at it. Uneasy. Easily annoyed. Never satisfied. Is that anybody here? How about... Oh, he says, unless... So, he says, the alcoholic is restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Does that happen to you? you're a little uptight, you're a little aggravated, you're feeling a little stressed out, you're a little feel nervous to talk to the girl, you don't know if you can make it to through Thanksgiving, you know, with and talking to the, you know, the 6-year-old and the 9-year-old about whatever's going on in their lives, because you're afraid that they may laugh at you or talk about you or say some sort of crazy thing, or they know that they're smarter than you and you believe that they're smarter than you, or any kind of other crazy thing like that. I mean, that's me at Thanksgiving, right? That's who shows up to my family on Thanksgiving. Right, I can't do that. I need a couple of drinks. I get a couple of drinks in me. I got ease and comfort. I can sort kind of deal with that. Does anybody feel that way? How about this? Does anybody feel that way on their way to the liquor store or to the liquor cabinet or to the garage? Without even being in their system, just knowing it's coming, they get this sense of ease and comfort. Just on the way, it's like, all right, it's almost here. It's going to be all right. Right? The doctor is saying right here, right, that we are restless, irritable, and discontented. He is not just talking about a guy who doesn't have willpower to stop drinking or a guy who only has a physical allergy. He's talking about a condition inside of my soul, inside of me, that is restless, never satisfied. I'm always annoyed, easily agitated. I can't rest. But if I have a few drinks, it gets better. He's saying, right, that unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes by taking a drink, they will eventually drink again. The doctor's telling me that I need to have ease and comfort in my life in order to stop drinking. Because if I am always restless, irritable, and discontented, I am going to pick up a drink. That's what he says right here. Restless, I need to, and here's the question, do I believe that in recovery that I must experience the sense of ease and comfort that I get by drinking? Do I need to experience in recovery that sense of peace and ease that I get when I take a drink? And do I realize, or am I willing to admit, that if I don't find that peace and ease inside of myself, that I'm going to drink again? For me, I know it. I got into a car accident. It was a little fender bender at a red light. It was 2 car lengths. He stopped short, and I hit him. But my mind goes to, you're a loser. As quickly as that. I'm driving along, Joe's spiritual. I got my spiritual AA notes all in my book. I'm, you know, studied this thing for a couple of hours. I'm ready to do the deal. Christmas, everyone's going to enjoy my presence. This is going to be a heck of a time. Boom, boom, boom. So, you know, car, bump, toe, Christmas presents out on the street. I want to die. Just like that. Now, I texted my sponsor. I called my sponsor right away. Before even the cops came, I called my sponsor. You know, I let out all the self-pity and the other stuff that comes with it. And I said, I'm sorry for the self-pity. Inventory is coming next. And I spent the next 2 hours crying and writing inventory. And then, after that inventory, ease and comfort. Okay. Good. Able to deal with whatever. The car's still in the lot. I'm all right. Mom and Dad are all right. Thank you, God. Right? But that's because I have, you know, I've experienced that ease and peace from doing this step work, that I know that I can go and do this step work some more to keep feeling that peace and that ease and that contentment. I don't need to run to the other things that I normally run to feel okay, to be cool, to get along, in, you know, with the gang or whatever the deal is. Okay? So the doctor says you need to have this sense of ease and comfort without a drink, otherwise you're going to drink. And then he says, when you do, you pass through all the well-known stages of a spree, remorse, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again, and this happens over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. There's very little hope of his recovery. This is, again, the doctor. He believes that there has to be an entire change in the way I think, in the way I behave, and the way I speak. Right? My thoughts, my words, and my actions. There has to be a change, a psychic change. Unless I can experience that change, there's very little hope of recovery. That's what the doctor's saying. That's the scientist. Right? You know, this isn't, again, this isn't the minister. And On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seems doomed, who had so many problems he ever despaired of solving them, is that anybody here? They have so many problems going on, they have no even idea how they're ever going to deal with any of them or all of them, right? The cop's on your back, the woman's on your back, you know, the husband's on your back, the parents on your back, the kids are flailing school, you're going to getting a divorce, they're separating, all of this stuff going on, they're going to take the house, or, you know, I'm going to get a raise, or all sorts of good things. I don't know how I'm going to deal with all these things. We're going to move, right? So many problems piling up that we don't even know how we're going to deal with them. Does anybody identify with that? Mm-hmm. He says that these people are doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them. Suddenly, this guy is able to control his desire for alcohol, and the only effort necessary is that he be required to follow a few simple rules, 12 steps. 12 steps, and that guy can all of a sudden deal with life's issues. All of a sudden, that guy can deal with life's problems. Doesn't mean that the problems go away. It means that I can deal with them. I can be okay being Michael and dealing with the problems. See, me, my deal is, the problems come, I'm going to the medicine cabinet. The problems come, I'm going on Backpage. The problems come, I'm going to the liquor store. The problems come, I'm going into the garage. Right? That's me. When the problems come, I run. I can't deal. Okay. We're going to talk about a guy. He's one of our founding members. He's on XXI. Again, this is still the doctor. This is still his letter. He's talking about a guy named, I believe, Hank Parkhurst. Okay? Now, here's a guy who was brought to him. He was treated for chronic alcoholism. He partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and had seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He'd lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. Has anybody felt that way? Or is anybody currently that way? Living just to drink. Living just for the next bottle, the next booze, the next substance, the next thing. Yeah? Living just to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, the guy comes to see the doctor, and he barely recognizes him, right? From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. Does anybody identify with trembling, despairing, nervous wreck? Without a drink. With or without a drink. Right? We're talking about alcoholism, not just a bottle, not just a substance. We're not just talking about alcohol. That's another group. Right? That's called Budweiser. We're talking about alcoholism. Right? A despairing, nervous wreck. This guy now, after following these simple rules, right, is brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. What's that mean? Ease and comfort. The restlessness, the irritability, and the discontentment is taken away. This guy goes through this process, and he's barely even recognizable. Even his facial features, he's different. There's something different about the guy, right? You hear people say, oh, she's got a glow about her. I don't know what it is about you. You got something going on. There's something happening, right? There's something alive and awake inside that is not just your features. There's something going on that I can see. I don't know what it is. I can't feel it, but I can see it going on with you. The doctor is saying that about a guy who's a totally hopeless alcoholic, who's a nervous, trembling wreck. He's a totally different person. Why? 12 steps, 1 year later. This is the guy. Okay? The doctor's giving you reasons why you may want to consider a spiritual path. 12 steps. Okay, here's another guy. A guy named Fitz Mayo, I believe. Okay? I identify with this guy. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation hopeless. He had hidden in a barn, a deserted barn, determined to die. Has anybody done that? You know, the modern day deserted barn is probably, you know, the local motel room. Anybody check into the motel room with every plan not to check out? Or check in to have a good time and then found themselves being pulled out on a stretcher? Or found themselves checking into a place like this and just wanting to die? You know, doing a leaving Las Vegas type of deal or some sort of situation like that. Me, I purposely every day, took salt, ripped it off the shakers, and sprinkled on salt over all of my food, you could see like a white snow, white Christmas over whatever it was, steak, pizza, pasta, whatever it was, because I knew that if you ate enough salt, you'd get high blood pressure and you would die. And that's the truth. I wanted out. Right? I smoked cigarettes. I smoked double and triple because I knew that if I kept smoking, I would die. I wanted to die. I was determined to die. Has anybody felt that way? Wanting to die or anything like that? If so, you may be like this guy Fitz. Right? This guy's so out there. Right? Rescue party's out to get him. He's in such a desperate place. They find him. They bring him to the doctor, thank God. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated, this is a waste of time unless I can assure him, which no one had ever had, that in the future he will have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem is so complex and his depression so great. Does anyone have a great depression or depression? Anybody identify with that? I did. Or how about the idea of an alcoholic, a complex alcoholic problem? Right? Got alcohol and a few other things going on. Yeah? Okay. Well, his depression was so great that we felt that his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, moral development. Moral development, still a term, right, that science has to say out there, right? We needed something, that this guy needed something called moral psychology. My sponsor had me underline that. He had me draw a little line underneath. He had me write spiritual awakening. We knew that what this guy needed was a spiritual awakening. And they're even saying, and we even doubted that would have any effect. This guy was so messed up. I don't even know if that's going to help him out. However, the guy becomes sold on the ideas contained in this book. He had not had a drink for so many years. I see him now and then. And this is the greatest compliment a man can ever get. One is greatest compliment anyone could ever give me. He's such a fine specimen of manhood as one could ever wish to meet. Now, that's the guy who pours salt all over his food. That's the guy who rips off the salt shaker and just swallows it whole. This is the guy who swallows pills and empties out the whole medicine cabinet because I want to prove to you how much you pissed me off last night. You know, this is the guy who's verbally and physically abusive in his relationships, who mocks and mimics and makes fun and gossip about and character assassinates everybody. Not just one or two people, everyone. Race, religion, sex, sexual preference, no matter what it is, I've spent my entire life from the age of 6 carrying on every stereotype of every nationality and religion and everything else for the next 30 years. This is the guy who walks into AA. I definitely needed some moral development. Ask my girlfriend, ask my parents, ask my neighbor, ask the cops. I needed some moral development. And this guy, Fitz Mayo, becomes such a fine specimen of manhood as one could ever wish to meet. And this doctor, he says these things because he is so relieved to see something is actually working after so many years of dealing with people like us. He says things like, the greatest compliments a man can ever hear, or maybe even a woman. You know, such a fine specimen of womanhood that a person could ever meet. And then the doctor ends it. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though he may scoff, he also may remain to pray. And that's the doctor. That's science. There's a little more science in here, and we can get to it. It's on page 26. All right? There's a guy. I went to Brookdale College for quite a while. And I took psychology. Psychology 101 was Dr. Carl Jung, okay? Freud, Jung, right? Still the deal if you want to, father of modern psychology, okay? This isn't some washed up has-been, okay? There's a guy believed to be Roland Hazard, okay? A businessman with good ability, good sense, good character. He flounders around from one rehab to another. Right? One, psych ward to another, consulted with the best American psychiatrists, And then he goes to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated Dr. Jung, who prescribes for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. This is a guy who goes to the number one psychiatrist in the world, right? And all of the best that America can give him, right? That he is now so kind of lit, you know, like he thinks he really has this thing with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition are unusually good. And above all, he had believed that he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. What is this guy? This is a guy who knows his triggers. Okay? This is a guy who knows his triggers. Anybody out there go to the therapist and they want to talk to you about therapists or triggers? This is a trigger, that's a trigger, this is a trigger, that's a trigger. Listen, I just walked by a heavy trigger. I was at my parents' house, walked by a trigger. It's called a Christmas tree. Right? You know? Right? Christmas tree, I'm drinking. Christmas tree, I ran away from home, 6 years old. Christmas tree, I ran again later on at 14. Christmas tree, I'm having a fight with mom in 1990, whatever, calling her a whole bunch of filthy names in front of the entire family. The whole house is filled with me swearing about my mother on Christmas. Moral psychology definitely needed over here. But here's a guy who knows all about his triggers, right? Knows all about his triggers, right? And then, that he thinks a relapse is unthinkable. Nevertheless, this guy is loaded in a short time. And more baffling still, he can't even give any satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he can't even say, oh my gosh, well, December 25th. Right? He's like, I have no idea. This guy knows his triggers so well. He's all equipped with all of the, people, places, and things, and all this other stuff that are going on, and that the things that they're telling him that he needs to stay away with or change, and all this other stuff, that he can't even understand what the hell happened. Right? So he's like, doctor, right? A paragraph down. He begs the doctor, please tell me the whole truth, okay? I gotta have it. And the doctor's judgment, he says, you are utterly hopeless. All right? You can never regain your position in society, and you'd have to place yourself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if you even expect to live long. And that is the great physician's opinion about a chronic alcoholic. Science. Science, this is what science has to say. Right? Next page. Some of our alcoholic readers may think that they can do without spiritual help. Is that you? How about now? You've got some time away from booze. Do you need God now? Or you got this thing? Are you in control of the picking up and the dropping down of booze and substance? Right? Are you all of a sudden the person who was powerless a couple years ago, but now you choose to drink no matter what? Somehow all of a sudden you don't need this spiritual stuff? It's possible you don't. You may not be a real alcoholic, but it's possible that if that's your experience, you don't fit the definition of a real alcoholic. But here's the question, though, right? Do I need this power today? Do I still believe I can do without spiritual help? I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, just last Sunday, I needed spiritual help. Mm-hmm. I'm a guy who wanted to, blow up on, the night before Christmas Eve. Things didn't kind of go the way I planned, and I was crying. So the doctor says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where the state of mind existed to the extent that it exists in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell closes in on him with a clang. He's like, is there no exception, guy? Yeah, there is. Exceptions to cases like yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. Now, he's not saying moral psychology. He's not talking about moral development. He's straight up saying, you need a vital spiritual experience. In cases like you, the chronic alcoholics, the regular relapse, you need a vital life-giving spiritual experience. And the doctor says, to me, these cases are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature, and here's what a nice definition. Oh, they come in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. And here's a little definition of what a spiritual experience can look like. Okay? Because I know we come in here, we're afraid of spiritual terms, right? We have some experiences maybe when we're younger, we have some experiences, or we have a whole lot of ignorance when it comes to these things, whatever it is for you, or you know, you hate them, or whatever it is, right? They just make you like kind of annoyed. Well, here's just a nice definition for those of us who feel that way. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces in the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new conception of ideas and motives begin to dominate them. Okay? Thoughts, feelings, belief systems. These are the things that need to change. The way I think, right? The things that I believe in, and the way I feel about things. My thoughts, my words, and actions. Okay? That's a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Okay? That's it. If you're having a problem with reading some of the other things here, just shoot for that. Okay? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which once the guiding forces of your life can be cast aside with a whole new bunch of thoughts, feelings, and motives to dominate you. Okay? The doctor says, in fact, I've been trying to produce such an emotional rearrangement within you. But with many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Okay? So here's another doctor, a little bit down the line. Okay? This hope was destroyed because the guy says, you know, well, that's good. I'm a church guy. You know, I go to church and all this other stuff. So, you know, vital spiritual experience. Cool. I'll go see the minister. You know, I'll go back to my church or whatever. And he says, you know, this hope, however, is destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions are very good, in his case, they do not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. The doctor's saying you need even something else to bring to that church experience so that you can move a little bit further along if you ever have a hope to not drink. He doesn't say to drink it, to live long. Okay? So here's some things about science, right? Here's some things that science has to say. Now, this is science's, some scientists' opinions about the need for something to change, not just mentally and not just physically with us, but that something else needs to happen, right? Bill's story on page 6. Here's a guy. He's swaying before an open window or a medicine cabinet where there's poison, cursing himself a weakling. The guy's thinking of killing himself. Right? The nightmare of the night before is so hellish, he fears that he would burst through the window and sash. Right? He feared for his sanity. Right? My brother, right? So here's a guy, he's suicidal. Like, he's thinking of, he wants to die, but he feels like he's too much of a chicken to go kill himself. Right? And he's like contemplating this idea of just checking out. Right? This alcohol thing has gotten him so bad. Right? All of a sudden, if you read his story before, when he talks about other people jumping out of buildings, he calls them, oh, I would never do that. Those weaklings. That's not me. And here he is, just a couple pages down the road, he's thinking about killing himself. Things that we said we would never do, and here we are doing them. Things that we said we would never participate in, we find ourselves participating in. Even breaking and considering breaking our own moral codes. Okay? He says, the curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. The decline of my moral health fell off like a ski jump. Here's a guy who's totally admitting that not only is booze a problem, but he is not the man that he thinks he should be or could be or was. I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, all of those Christmases and Christmas 10 years ago, I was not John and Joan's little boy. I guarantee you that. I may have looked like it. I may have put on the song and dance for them. But inside, I was not the person that they created me to be. You know, my father never laid a hand on a woman. My father never called my mother a dirty name. My father never raised his voice. He never even cursed. And I become the total opposite of all of those things. So I wasn't a guy who learned this stuff. I was brought up with a nice kind of like, you know, foundation of morals and ways to behave and ways to treat or whatever. And I become a beast. You know, but to me, the Hulk. You know, waking up the next day, my shirt's scratched, my face is scratched, I'm wearing different clothes, there's holes in the walls, and what happened last night? Right? I'm kind of like this guy, David Banner, always in search of trying to keep this animal at bay. That's the truth. And I'm doing it to this day, too. You know, I'm doing anything I can to keep that, to get and contain and maintain that peace and ease that I must have. Otherwise, the Hulk is out on a run. And it's not, and I tell you, you know, it's not going to be pretty if the Hulk ever comes out of this guy. And later on, he says, she would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They didn't tell me. I knew, and I almost welcomed the idea. Here's the guy again. He wants to die, right? So on page 18. It says, an illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness, involves all those about us in no way a human sickness can. Okay? Here's a question. Do I believe that I have an illness? Number one. Number two, do I believe that I have an illness physically? Do I believe that I have an illness mentally, mind that brings me back to things that are going to kill me? And do I believe that it's a spiritual illness? It's good questions to ask ourselves, right? It's good to ask yourself this any point in time in the game, right? It says the alcoholic illness affects the lives of those around them. It touches the lives of the sufferers. It brings around misunderstanding. Anybody have misunderstandings in their families? How about misunderstandings in their jobs or relationships with their children, with their parents, with their family? Yeah? How about fierce resentment? Not just you resenting everybody else. How about some people who resent you for the things that you've done? Financial insecurity? It's not talking about money, how much you have or don't have. Just this insecurity with, you know, do I have enough? It's going to happen. Am I going to get the raise? Am I going to not get the raise? Oh my gosh, what if they raise my mortgage or whatever the heck? Just this insecurity, this kind of constant issue with money. Right? Disgusted friends. Anybody have them? I do. How about disgusted employers? I've been asked to leave. Warped lives of blameless children. Sad wives. Parents. Definitely identify. Sad girlfriends for sure. And can the list go on and on? Right? This is restlessness, irritability, and discontented. The question is where are you now? Without a drink, are you still like this? Are there some areas where you have fierce resentment or financial insecurity? And the question is, what am I not doing? Right? 10 years sober, what am I not doing? Did I finish my amends? Am I still holding stuff from my fourth step? Did I not bring it up on the fifth step? You know, am I not praying, meditating, writing the nightly review inventory? Am I, you know, not picking up the phone call for the new guy? Or girl, what am I not doing? Because if I'm having these things going on in my life, there's something going on inside of me. And it's untreated alcoholism. This thing has got to be, they say, maintained every day. How do I do it? What am I doing to treat my spiritual illness now? And then there's the granddaddy, right? This is the one that says, sir, give me the pen. This is for mine. This is my experience, okay? It doesn't have to be you. Okay? But, page 52. Here we go. We have to ask ourselves a few questions. All right? Am I having trouble with personal relationships? When they come in here, anybody having trouble with personal relationships? How about now? How about today? Are you able to control your emotional nature? You know? One minute you're happy, one minute you're angry, one minute you're smiling, next thing you know you're throwing the dog across the room. Yeah? Prey to misery. Right? Here's the deal. Prey. Right? So there's these two birds. One is called misery, and the other one is called depression. And they're just flying around, right? They're vultures waiting to come and get me, right? The vulture of misery and depression is just always flying around me, just waiting to hunt me down, waiting to put me out, you know, take me out to the kill, waiting for me to just be weak enough so it can totally snap me, start feeding off of me. Does anybody identify with that? Can I make a living? And the question isn't just, how am I doing at my job? The question is how am I doing at the traffic light? You know, how am I doing at life? You know, can I do Christmas shopping without wanting to kill everybody? You know, how am I doing at life? You know, can I do Thanksgiving now without a drink in me 10 years? Or am I still like the whole thing with the 9-year-old and the 10-year-old, there's all this still going on with me? Right? Am I full of fear? Do I have a feeling of uselessness? I identify with all of these things. With me, it's ding, 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 ding. Am I unhappy? Ding. Can I seem to be of any real help for other people? Well, I could take out the garbage, you know, but usually I'll mess it up. Or I could take it out, but not without a fight. You know what I mean? Not without like some, or wanting a badge, you know, or something like that, right? But let me tell you, by this point in time, I don't do raking the lawn well. I don't do mowing the lawn well. I break all of those things. Those things get in the way, right? Like these machines and other stuff. I don't even mow the lawn well at, you know, 35 years of age when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do life scenarios too well at all, okay? And then here's another way. Could I seem to be of any real help to other people? So another way of looking at it is, you know, with or without a drink, you know, when's the last time someone called up and said, hey, listen, I'm going through something right now. I wanted to get your feedback on something. You know, that's real help to other people. People calling me up and asking for, what's your experience like? I'm having some issues with my relationship. I'm having some issues with a sponsee. I'm having some issues with, family life. Right? That's real help of other people. I mean, taking out the garbage is nice, right? You know, but that's the best I can do when I walk in here. But here's the other thing is where am I now with all of this stuff? Right? This is called untreated alcoholism. Right? I'm doing the rest of this. I'm telling you right now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm doing the rest of this stuff because I do not want to feel, I want to be rid of the trouble with the personal relationship. I want to be a gentleman. That's what it is. I want to be a gentleman. I want to be able to be in a relationship and hold the door open and close the door and have a disagreement without like yelling and screaming and carrying on in the public or in private. You know? I want to be able to do Thanksgiving and wish them well and mean it. I want to be able to, you know, sit at the traffic light and just enjoy the light Beatle music in the background without, like, you know, having a conversation with my boss, you know, or rerunning the conversation what I'm going to say at the meeting later on because it's a third step meeting, right? I got all this stuff going, right? I just want to be able to just deal with life, okay, right? You know, I don't want to be full of fear. I come in here, I'm afraid to drive on the roads. I'm afraid to drive in narrow lanes. I'm afraid to be in between two trucks. I'm afraid to be behind the trucks with all the cars on it. I can't just, you know, I can't get from one place to another without fear. You know, I can't go into this town. I can't go down in this town. You know, like, to go from the Italian ice store to my parents' house, I had to drive 30 minutes. You know what I mean? Because I'm afraid of the Homedale cops, and I can't see the Hazel cops either, and all this other stuff. I'm full of fear. Can't do it. You know? And be of real help to other people. When I was younger, my mother said, you should be a marriage counselor because everyone comes to your problems. At 35 years of age, none of that. If anything, I need a marriage counselor. You know, actually, I need somebody's help to tell me what's going on. So for me and for this alcoholic, right, that untreated alcoholism, those feelings is why I do everything else. Besides that, I also, because I know that if I'm feeling this way, a drink is coming. If I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, I am picking up a drink. That is my truth, without a doubt. The question is, do you believe it, and do you still believe it today, no matter where you are in this process, right? And how do I know? Take a look. Did you do your nightly review last night? Do you still have some unfinished amends? Because if there's things you're not working on your spiritual life, somewhere in the back of my head, I think I have power again. Somehow I think I'm in control. Somehow I think, I have power and choice over this thing. So, thanks for enduring this hour with me. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.